Board of Appeals. Have all counsel received our written statement of instructions, and do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor, we received them.
For the members of the audience, one of those instructions is if you have a cell phone, please turn it off so that the attorneys aren't interrupted during their argument. Preliminary matter, we would appreciate both sides addressing somewhere during their argument, and certainly without prejudice to any other positions you wish to take. Were we to remand, and this may be primarily a concern of the plaintiffs, would you want the opportunity to present additional evidence? And this may be an equal issue of both parties. Some of the federal cases we alluded to in the request for supplemental authority suggest that there should be a preponderance of the evidence burden of proof in cases of this nature. If either of you has a position one way or the other on that, we would be interested in hearing it. That said, we are ready for argument on behalf of Unicom.
May it please the court, I'm Rachel Yates, bar number 20041. This case involves a Rule 23F appeal of the class certification order regarding alleged asbestos contamination. Unical articulated a number of points of error in its briefs, and I'm not going to go through those because what we're seeing is a fundamental error and mistake that permeates all those points of errors. Specifically, the district court believed that it could not consider particular evidence, expert testimony, documentary evidence, which Unical presented because it would unduly infringe on the merits of the case. Although the court was conducting an evidentiary hearing, it felt unduly constrained that it could not decide conflicting points of evidence. And as a result of the flawed approach that the court then took, the plaintiffs were not obligated to meet the burden of proof on each Rule 23 element, nor to show an injury in fact for each class member. And the burden was shifted to Unical to disprove that. There were three categories of evidence that I think helped to demonstrate that. Evidence which the landowners offered that Unical did not challenge, such as the typicality of the class representatives. Then there was evidence which Unical offered that the landowners did not challenge, and evidence that both sides offered that was in dispute. On the far end of the spectrum then, Unical offered evidence as to its unique affirmative defenses to demonstrate that the evidence needed for a class determination would be very individualized, and therefore the predominance element could not be met. For example, there were releases signed by particular landowners. Some landowners didn't even have the pipeline removed. Others had alternate sources of asbestos.
Are you making that point only as to preponderance, and do you concede that there was a sufficient showing below of commonality and typicality for purposes
Yes.
of 23A?
Yes, Your Honor. We did concede typicality and commonality.
And that continues to be your position, I
Correct.
Think. And also adequacy of representation, you concede?
We did not concede it below. We have, I think, conceded it on appeal.
Thank you.
With respect to the evidence on predominance and our affirmative defenses and other defenses, the court ruled that it could not consider that evidence, even though it was unrebutted by the plaintiffs. And it felt it could not consider those because it went to the merits of the case and would have to await disposition at trial when Unical had finally proven its affirmative defenses. The court didn't consider it for the reason offered, which was to show the necessity of individualized proof, and therefore, defeating the predominance element. For the evidence that was in conflict, that both sides presented, again, the court deferred ruling. It said, because the evidence is conflicting, I cannot decide it at this stage. It specifically ruled that expert testimony, which is in conflict, may not be considered at the class certification stage.
Is there any dispute that the easement-class properties have suffered asbestos contamination?
There is no dispute that there is asbestos along the pipeline easement. The question that hangs us up in terms of predominance is, how big is that easement? Because under Colorado law, if the asbestos has extended or is limited to the easement, then arguably no trespass claim will lie under Colorado law.
If
it extends beyond the easement.
Well, so there's three geographic issues, and there's the easement itself, there's what plaintiffs call the easement properties, and then there's the contiguous property.
Correct.
Is there, do you maintain there's a factual dispute as to whether asbestos has migrated beyond the easement itself onto some of the easement properties?
Yes. For example, we presented one easement that was the entire ranch. That was the width of the easement.
Well, what about the others where the easement itself is narrower than what are called the easement properties?
That's the dilemma. It's going to take a case-by-case analysis of each of those 66 easements along the property to know for certain, because we don't know how wide those easements are. Typically, the asbestos has only been seen within about 50 feet of the pipeline center line. It has been seen as far as 200 feet from the pipeline center line. But until we know the width of the easement, we don't know if it's extended beyond that legal interest.
Why couldn't you have ascertained that below just by examining the real estate records? I mean, I assume the easements are all recorded.
You could, and it would need to be done, obviously. But the point then will be each class member will have a different argument raised as to it. There will be some for whom they have a blanket easement and therefore no trespass claim will lie. Others that have a narrow easement and will have to have introduce evidence as to the asbestos in relation to that particular easement. Those types of individualized inquiries go directly against the CLASP approach, and they show why those common issues are not predominant.
Your argument, Ms. Yates, here is not that the court needed to decide that issue, if I'm tracking with you. The court didn't have to say this person had asbestos in the easement property, this one did not. You're saying that the court didn't even inquire at all as to whether that was an issue. And there are, and I think your point is the court needs to ask the question, and that shows the individual issues predominate. Am I understanding you?
Correct. The case law, including the recent decision from the Supreme Court in the Farmers Insurance case, requires the plaintiffs to advance a method by which they can prove all that on a class approach. And our argument below on predominance was that you cannot do it on a class-wide basis. It's going to be very individualized. The court, however, said you didn't prove your affirmative defenses yet, and so I won't consider them at all. And we believe that was a point of error. With respect then to the properties that were in the contiguous class, there was no evidence presented whatsoever that they were contaminated at all, except for an air model, which the plaintiffs wished to use. Unical presented evidence that those assumptions underlying that air model had never been established and, in fact, were contrary to the actual evidence. Worse, the air model only purported to show where the asbestos might have been in 1996, which was outside the limitations window, not where it might be today.
Now, with respect to the experts, Ms. Yates, how far did the court need to go here? I think this may be different than your affirmative defense argument. It sounds to me like you're saying the court needed to decide the battle of the experts and needed to basically say this air model doesn't fly because there's a data point outside the relevant period, et cetera.
That's correct. In fact, we would urge the court to adopt the approach in the IPO and hydrogen peroxide cases, where the court specifically said the expert testimony should not be just uncritically accepted simply because it might pass a Daubert or here a Schreck challenge or is not otherwise fatally flawed.
Well, where's the line on that question then? Let's take a different hypothetical. I understand you say here the Guinnessian, if that's how you say it, the model was faulty and the expert who relied on it therefore was faulty. Let's take a closer case. Let's say there's no issue with the assumptions made in the model. And so the expert on the plaintiff's side says there's no question in my mind that the asbestos got here. Here's the model. The assumptions are right or at least not challenged. you have an expert on your side that says the opposite. I think this doesn't hold up. So it's a pretty close battle of experts on, let's say, an issue that goes to one of the Rule 23 factors. What do you do in that case? Does the court then get to say, you know, this one really is for the jury? And where's the line?
I don't think here it was close enough that we would have ever reached that. I think that the district courts should have to make those determinations, weighing the expert testimony by the preponderance of the evidence standard, including weighing expert credibility, which is what was done in the hydrogen peroxide case. And so in those instances, the court should have said there is a complete absence of proof here, and all the proof demonstrates there is no contamination, and therefore I will find that there is no injury in fact to those property owners. I do think that is a decision for the district court to make. It will not be binding ultimately on whether there is contamination that can be established to have caused an injury. That will be for the jury's determination as to whether there's been loss of use, a need for a remediation plan, and that sort of thing. But for purposes of whether this may proceed procedurally as a class, the court should have made those determinations of weighing the expert testimony and credibility. Here, it's not even a close call. I think the manifest weight of the evidence was that there was no such evidence of contamination.
This is exclusively a land damage case. There are no personal injury, medical monitoring type issues.
There are no health claims, which would include medical monitoring. There is personal injury with respect to loss of use and enjoyment or inconvenience and annoyance type.
Or should it say physical injury?
That's correct.
Okay.
I would like to reserve my remaining time.
May it please the court, Kevin Hannon, number 16015, also with me and my co-counsel and our clients. Your Honor, I want to address some of the issues that came up in the argument first. You asked about the remand issue. I think it depends on how the court frames its decision here, but we should be given the option depending on what the court says.
The option to present additional expert testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the preponderance standard, that's a clear issue here. The preponderance of evidence standard is a fact-finding standard, and it goes to the issue of whether there's a merits determination here. There's not, if we take, for example, superiority, there's no preponderance of the evidence standard that would apply to the court's discretionary decision on superiority. Same thing with predominance. The preponderance of the evidence standard is a fact-finding evidence standard that hasn't anything to do with the court's discretionary determination of whether common issues predominate here.
Well, so the by what standard do we measure the sufficiency of the record if the trial court concludes there is predominance? I mean, if we're not going to look at the record for purpose under a preponderance standard, what do we look at?
You look at examination the court did of the record and whether it abused its discretion given all the evidence. You can't apply a fact-finding standard here. It's not a fact-finding issue. The court's making a case management decision based on whether all these issues that are presented, and we can take the easement issue as an example. I want to address that. But the court's making a decision of whether it's better to manage these claims in a class certification context.
If I ask the same question, what standard does the trial court apply? So the court decides predominance here. By what standard does the court decide that?
The case law guides us in that. First of all, the case law says that a single issue of liability can predominate. And so if there's a single issue of liability here, focused on liability that predominates, then you can uphold certification. The trial court can decide that Rule 23 should apply here.
But and the court, I'm not tracking with you, and I apologize if it's my fault here. But what the court is making findings of those Rule 23 factors. what's the standard by which the court decides that? You say one factor. Here in this case, we have arguably a battle of the experts. And the court says, I think the common issues predominate or whatever it may find. By what standard does the court judge that? If there's any scintilla of evidence that the plaintiff produces, is that enough, even in the face of a dispute from the other side?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't know if any scintilla is standard, but if we looked at what the parties argued here and what the law is, first of all, Benzing says that generally accept the allegations in support of certification. That's our Supreme Court giving us a standard that applies here. So that's one standard that applies here. Number two, if you had a pure battle, and I'm not talking about a merits issue, but let's assume you had a pure battle on the issue of methodology, and I think that's what you were alerting to earlier, then the standard ought to be that the court evaluates the evidence. It generally accepts the allegations in support of class certification because it's not to decide the merits. And it only rejects that expert testimony if it is so flawed as to be inadmissible, the In Re Visa check standard. And what's important here is that when we look at the defendant's focus basically on two sentences in the opinion, this can't decide the merits standard and the can't resolve affirmative defenses. I mean, there are really two sentences that permeate defendant's argument that they pull out of the trial court's decision. And if we look at why that sentence is in there, it's because the defendants, in their proposed order, stated that you can't resolve the merits of an expert dispute, and stated that the resolution of that is the only time you can is if the citing the In Re Visa check standard, the opinion is so flawed as to be inadmissible. Defendants relied on that standard in their proposed order. They argued it at the hearing, and then in their opening brief here, before you raised the IPO issue, they relied on that standard again. And all the trial court was doing here was addressing that standard. Just like with regard to the affirmative defense sentence, what the court said, and the court goes on in its order and says, even if Unical's affirmative defenses raised individual issues, these individual questions do not undermine predominance, where common questions otherwise predominate. And the court had already identified two paragraphs above the specific issues that relate to defendants' defenses.
The court also characterized somewhat dismissively the defenses as, quote, untested, close quote. Well, is there any legal basis for refusing or declining to inquire into affirmative defenses because they're untested?
See, Your Honor, that's the issue here. Because, for example, let's take the easement issue. The court didn't decline to consider that issue. That there was testimony on the easement issue at the hearing, both from Mr. Roberts and the two easements the defendant put before the court. And the court considered that as part of its consideration of the entire record during a two-day hearing. What did those easements mean?
And there's no finding on that.
What's that?
There is no specific finding.
There's no specific finding. But the court says specifically in its order, it talks about whether the claims are barred by the statute of limitations, compensated, all these other affirmative defenses. The fact that the court doesn't make an affirmative finding on each issue, each defense that the defendant raised, doesn't mean that it's an abuse of discretion. But to go back to the easement issue, we also produced law that said that, I think the law is clear that if you can still trespass even if you have an easement to a property. So it wasn't cut and dried that the court didn't consider the easements. The court did consider the easements to the extent that the defendants produced them. Bill Sierra says that the defendants can't just rely on their pleadings. It's got to produce some evidence about how this evidence played out. Two easements is not enough to defeat predominance here. And on top of it, we had the common legal issue of whether or not a trespass can occur even if you hold an easement interest. Well, so that was a common...
Mr. Hannon, it isn't exactly what the court said is some evidence indicating that the court's already crossed the threshold of making some determination about the quality of the evidence.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the some evidence standard, first of all, IPO talks about some evidence as the entire Rule 23 determination. The some evidence here, the only issue of some evidence is whether the plaintiffs presented evidence, he didn't use the word some in this regard, in terms of the identifiability of the class. And here we go back to the standard. That was the only area of expert dispute here, was the identifiability of the class. And what the plaintiffs did was produce evidence, and the court specifically found that it wasn't so flawed as to be inadmissible. So it's evidence on whether or not these contiguous properties can be differentiated from the general population of properties.
And it's your position that in a class action that is primarily determinable by expert testimony, as a lot of these would be, as long as the plaintiff's expert passes the junk science threshold of Dolbear and Schreck, that ends the inquiry?
Well, on a particular issue, the answer is yes at this class certification stage, because if you go to a Schreck standard, for example, here you basically getting into the merits of these issues. And so, for example, here, there's a dispute about whether or not the wrap was wet as part of the assumptions. Well, if you go into that dispute, you're basically going to have a fact-finding mission that's part of the trial. And you can't do that.
Why does that necessarily implicate the merits? If you have a battle of the experts and you have to determine as a preliminary matter whether you're even going to accept the testimony, why are you dealing with the merits and making a rigorous investigation of the experts' qualifications and the opinion, whether the opinion holds water?
The court did that here because the defendants attacked the qualifications, the defendants attacked the assumptions, and the court made its analysis and accepted this evidence as evidence that these properties can be distinguished. So the court did that here. There was no reason to apply some new gloss or standard to what the court did. It considered that evidence and basically 2 days of hearing focused on this model and the assumptions. And it's important to note that this, in our case, it wasn't the model that was the basis or the sole basis for this decision. As we indicated in our briefs, Dr. Spear's testimony was the basis for the decision. The model was one component. But for example, when defendant says that it was based on modeling in 1996 or wind data in 1996, Dr. Spear had testimony or had data over a period of years of wind data showing that the wind data was consistent. A decade of wind data up through 2005, the most recent wind data that was available. So it wasn't the model that was the basis for these properties can be distinguished. That's all the issue is here, whether these properties can be distinguished from others.
Well, isn't the issue that you have to, let me ask it this way, don't you have to prove that every class member suffered harm, even though the degree of harm may be a separate question?
Now, absolutely not at the class certification stage. That is not the distinguishing factor for whether this class is identifiable.
So you,
the
can
question,
have, you can have a class that where the only person who has harm in a 1,000-member class is a representative plaintiff?
No. What we produced here was evidence that all these class properties were distinguishable from other properties based on the summary of evidence that included Dr. Spear and one of those factors being the model.
But you keep using the phrase distinguishable. Aren't they distinguishable because you believe you proved either that they've been directly contaminated or they're sufficiently proximate to other properties that were directly contaminated to suffer a diminution in reasonable use and enjoyment?
Those would be two factors. Another factor is that they are proximate to an admitted source of asbestos contamination and proximate to the effects of consistent conduct along 69 miles of pipeline.
Well,
and
what's
so
the significance of proximity if it doesn't produce a colorable claim of damage?
Yeah, that's part of it, and they are in a position of risk, as shown by the modeling and Dr. Spears' testimony. So the point is we produced sufficient evidence that these properties are identifiable in comparison to the properties in general. Your Honor, if we take the prove injury standard, then we are going into the merits, and we're actually making a merits decision. And the benzene case just said that although the court may analyze the substantive claims and damages that will be raised to determine whether class certification is appropriate, it cannot prejudge the merits. Just 2 months ago, our Supreme Court said that. In considering whether to maintain a class, a court may not decide the substantive claims and defenses of the parties. Separate statement. Another statement. It may not determine whether the class will ultimately succeed in establishing each element to prove its claims. Benzing made those three statements just 3 months ago, each going to the fact that the conclusion that the court may not make a determination on the merits.
Is it your position, Mr. Hannon, that Benzing is inconsistent with LaBarenne's decision of this court from 2007? In there, the division said to be members of a class, individuals must have been injured or suffered damage, although at the class certification stage, the plaintiffs need not show the amount of damage. Plaintiffs must show that all putative class members were damaged. Do you take the position that Benzing overruled that?
Yeah, absolutely. Benzing's clearly inconsistent with Benzing. But on top of that, Your Honor, LaBarenne's is distinguishable because the issue there was whether that the defendant had produced evidence, in fact, that there could not be harm. And that evidence in LaBarenne's was undisputed. And that is what the court focused on in making that statement. So if we had a different, that's not the situation here. We don't have a situation where it's undisputed that there's not harm. And I think that's what led LaBarenne's to draw that conclusion. And in that case, arguably, what LaBarenne should have said is possibly injured. But there was not, based on admitted evidence, there wasn't a dispute that of any injury. And of course, in LaBarenne's, the court did certify another class based on different evidence where it did conclude that there was a possibility of injury. So I think absolutely.
So if you'd wrap up in a sentence or two, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I want to step back here. What we had was a court that looked at multiple pleadings. We had a court that had a two-day hearing. We had a court that considered many exhibits. We had a court that considered expert testimony on both sides of an issue. A court that it issued a 15-page order where it identified the defenses, for example, identified and specifically looked at the expert testimony. And when the court is making a determination on how to manage the case, not a merits determination, as Benzing says clearly, but on how to manage the case, we cannot, on this record, say that the court abused its discretion.
Thank you.
Hope this won't be too disjointed. Benzing did not overrule LaBarenne's, which clearly addresses the need for proof of injury. In fact, although I've only got the slip opinion on page 20, part of the justification for allowing the motion to decertify was that the defendant's argument demonstrated there would be individual inquiries as to whether there was injury to each of the class members. So that clearly remained a standard even in the Supreme Court's decision. There's no express or implied indication that Labyrinth was overturned. Second, the district court below did a very good job of allowing the evidence to come in. In the course of that two-day hearing, it took evidence, and we believe there is no need to return for taking of additional evidence. The problem came when the court declined to weigh that evidence and said, I have to accept the plaintiff's allegations as true, and I'm going to apply a sum evidence standard, which it did on pages 6 and 8 of the opinion. And based on that, I need go no further. And in fact, I cannot go further. It's not that the court considered our evidence and said, I find in favor of the landowners nonetheless. It said, I cannot consider it because it is in conflict at this point in time. So what we are requesting is the court to clarify the standards for the district courts. That is of importance not only below, but generally for the district courts in Colorado. And to adopt the clarifying standards that are set forth in the majority position of the federal circuits, which have been articulated in IPO and hydrogen peroxide. With respect to the contiguous property class, that issue has been sufficiently briefed to this court that you could make a determination not only to reverse, but to substantively decide the issue because you've got what you need to make that decision. And no remand would be necessary with respect to the contiguous property class. The proximity stigma argument is one purely a question of law, and it would be useful to have the court decide that in particular. For the easement property class, we would request that the court reverse and remand for additional findings, but not for the taking of additional evidence. If anything, that would probably help UNICAL because it was all of our evidence that got excluded. But we think it was adequately presented to the district court. We had an opportunity to do so, and no additional evidence need be taken. But reverse and remand as to the issues of predominance, numerosity, and superiority, with instructions to follow the new clarifying standards that this court is issuing.
But I apologize if I wasn't listening precisely. You're not asking for an opportunity to present additional evidence, which the plaintiffs reserve the right to do.
I obviously, if the court opens it up for the taking of additional evidence, we'd like the chance to respond to whatever they present.
But you don't want additional evidence if we just remand for more findings?
I don't think it's necessary on those three issues. Without this approach, we end up having a default always in favor of class certification and a shifting of the burden of proof to UNICAL to disprove the Rule 23 standards. What we're seeing, for example, in the Farmers Insurance case out of the Supreme Court, there the defendant was obligated to come back with new evidence or new law to support overturning the earlier decision, justifying a change in the status quo. If the court, in the first instance, on a motion to certify the class, doesn't take a hard look at the evidence, conduct that rigorous analysis, and actually weigh the evidence on a preponderance standard, then you will have, callously, a drive-by certification that shifts the burden improperly to a defendant to disprove. We know Colorado law says the plaintiff always bears that burden of initially proving its case for certification. And so we urge the court to reverse the class certification order.
Before the lower court, did you argue that class certification, if any, should be conditional, consistent with the distinction between the state and federal rule?
I don't know that we argued it should be. We understood it could be or would be conditional. And although the federal circuit, the two cases you pointed to, looked at that issue, both ultimately concluded that the changes to the federal rule didn't provide sufficient clarity did not address the substantive standard, and therefore they had to go forward with the analysis of how they came to the adopt the majority position. In fact, they relied on cases that predated the 2003 amendments.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. On that basis, counsel are excused. This exhausts our special session docket, and the bailiff may announce a recess.